Next year marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, who was then 3 years into his first term as a U.S. senator and just 80 days into his candidacy for president of the United States. Chris Matthews, the host of MSNBC's Hardball, has written about RFK's brother, JFK, in the books Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, and Kennedy and Nixon, and now turns his eyes on RFK in the book Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, and he's here to talk about it. Hi, Chris. How are you?
It's great to be on.
Nice to have you on here. Why, after writing so much about the Kennedy family, did you decide to return and write about Bobby?
Well, one thing I discovered is that there couldn't have been a Jack without a Bobby, and that is so true. If you look at the first race for the Senate in 1952, Bobby basically took over and saved that campaign. In 1960, he ramrodded that whole election campaign. He was the key figure. And then when you get into the Kennedy presidency, if you look at civil rights, Bobby was the one pushing Jack to go on television and come out for the civil rights bill. He was the one that got him really through the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was his solution going to make the trade with the American missiles in Turkey for the Soviet missiles in Cuba that saved the day. He was always the shrewd advisor to his brother Jack, and I think the indispensable advisor. So that's when I first got into it, Bobby, and why I went to him next.
You make it sound like of the three brothers, Jack, Bobby, and Ted, that Bobby was the most impressive.
Well, he was the brains in a way. I think he had the brains, so did Jack, but he had brains too. I think he was the conscience. He was very religious, and I think that doesn't always work out in politics, but sometimes it does. I think he had a real conscience about civil rights, and I think during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when all the people like General LeMay were calling for a big bombing of Cuba, he said, wait a minute, Americans are not like the Empire of Japan. We're not Tojo. We're not going to go in and bomb and kill a lot of people because of a geopolitical reason. And they basically went to the embargo instead, which avoided a war with Russia. And I really think he had a conscience. I'm not saying he was a perfect man, but he cared about poverty. He cared about white poverty, black poverty, California farm workers, Native Americans. He really was a well-rounded guy when it came to caring about showing empathy for other people with their problems.
Yeah, I really get the sense in reading your book that Bobby, I was going to say alone among the brothers, but that isn't really right, more than his brothers, wanted to help the disenfranchised.
He was, and I tried to figure out why, and I really worked on that why question, like you do in a biography, and I trace it back to his birth order. He was the seventh of the kids. He was the runt. His father called him a runt, which is a brutal thing to hear from your father, since you have nothing to do with how tall you are. He was 5'8 or so. He was his brothers were strapping six-footers and very confident socially. He was not. He was awkward. I think he began to identify with people that were left out, people who were overlooked, dismissed, discarded. As a very young guy, and his father would make fun of him for that. He would say, can't we do something for the poor people? And his father said, I don't know why you're talking about that. And somebody once said that Bobby was very empathetic and very generous. And the father said, I don't know where he got that from, making fun of it. And so Bobby became a tough guy for his father and eventually became his brother's enforcer and called ruthless. And then I think only in the end, when his father faded with his because of his stroke, Bobby became the guy he was at the beginning, the kid he was, which was a generous, positive, empathetic person.
When you first heard that he was going to run for president, you write in the book that that was on March 16th, 1968. And just a side note, how amazing that we had somebody deciding to run for president less than 8 months before the election. Not 3 years, not 4 years, not 8 years before, but 8 months before.
And it was that helter-skelter. I mean, it wasn't just late. It was awkward. He got in the race long after he decided he wasn't going to get in the race. He didn't want to get in the race. He thought his time was 72, that if he just waited his turn, he'd be president automatically. He'd have an ability to restore Camelot and all that New Frontier stuff and be his brother's successor. But the war is what drove him. There's no doubt the war drove him in the sense that the country was overlooking its problems at home and dividing at home. And so he went into the race after Gene McCarthy, right before Johnson quit. Johnson only quit the 31st of March, 2 weeks later. You're right. Historically now, like Barack Obama, I mean, I think he announced in January of 07. You announced basically 2 years ahead of time now.
Yeah. You were a grad student at UNC right when Bobby announced his candidacy.
Right.
Were you a supporter?
I was with Gene in the beginning, Gene McCarthy. We were all with Gene McCarthy because he was the first guy to win the race against Johnson. And then we rooted for him in New Hampshire, and then Bobby jumped in. And eventually I began to realize going into California, a big primary there in June, that Bobby was the only one with a chance. I mean, a chance to beat Humphrey, who had become Johnson's candidate and a war supporter. I mean, I thought the only way to end the war was Bobby, and I was praying for him to win that primary. And then I prayed for him to live. I mean, it was, the whole thing was so emotional back then. Everything, imagine this, well, you know the history. The series begins with Bobby going into the, Gene McCarthy going in, basically giving a scare of his life to Johnson. Bobby goes in the race. Johnson pulls out of the race. Martin Luther King is killed. Bobby is killed. I mean, this series of events has been nothing ever like it.
And then that Democratic convention in Chicago. Horrible. Was just, you know, the whole world's watching. What a nightmare that year was.
Well, it was terrible. And there were no real good guys at that convention. There were, the police behaved, misbehaved, and a lot of the students were horrible at provoking the police. Terrible things were done to those police to get them so angry. And it wasn't clean-cut college kids against the police. It was a rough confrontation.
Let's play the hypothetical game. If Bobby had not been assassinated, would he have gotten enough delegates to become the candidate and beat Humphrey and then go on to face Nixon?
Well, Paul, you know, it was different back then. First of all, the thing that makes it wide open, and yes, the answer is yes, is because back then we only had about five or six, we only had a handful, really, of primaries. Everything was decided by big bosses in states, like the party boss or the governor would basically decide how the delegations were going. So when they got to Chicago in that summer, after all the help, I assume Bobby would have won New York, although it wouldn't have been easy. He would have won New York. He would have won California. He would be, maybe McCarthy would have faded, but I'm not sure. He would have gone into that convention. Remember what it was like when he went into the 64 convention. The whole place melted. 20 minutes of applause.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it could have been like that again in 68. So instead of the student riots and the police rioting, it would have been Bobby Kennedy coming to Chicago and picking up the mantle of his brother for the Democratic Party, and maybe by then Dick Daley, the mayor, behind him. And I think Daley behind him by then. And then it would have been this magical moment of the delegates actually making up their minds while they're at the convention. The hard thing about predicting that is that it never would have, we've had nothing like it since, where delegates really were free to make up their minds. And Bobby might have been able to turn that whole thing. He had a pretty good organization.
All right, so let's assume that that's true, and he would have gone on to do that. Then, does Richard Nixon lose to a Kennedy for the second time?
Yeah, that's one thing I'm pretty sure of. In the book, I have Nixon watching Kennedy announce on that day, March 16th.
Yeah.
Nixon's in Oregon. He's in Portland at the Hotel Benson. And he's there watching TV, and he's watching Bobby announce. And it's one of those things, like only on television or movies, somebody stands there looking at the television with it turned off. And Nixon kept looking at the blank screen, saying forces will be unleashed now that we cannot imagine. Who knows where this is going to take us? I think Nixon was spooked. And I think the Kennedys had beaten him badly. I worked for Tip O'Neill, as you know, all those years, and he worked up in Massachusetts with the Kennedys. He said, you don't lose to the Kennedys. They're just, back in those days, they were unbeatable. So I think that Nixon faded. Remember how badly he faded against Humphrey?
Yep.
He lost like a 30-point lead. So I think he would have lost, yeah. I think the country was ready to end the war. And Bobby, well, he looked fantastic as a candidate. And, you know, who knows? But, yes, it would have changed history. And the great thing about it would be the war would have lasted half as long. The division in America we haven't gotten over since would be half as bad. And I think we'd be in a better shape right now.
In reading that part of the book where you talk about Nixon watching that announcement and then watching the blank screen of the TV, I could picture the famous Nixon sweat starting.
Yeah. And there's that great scene when Nixon and Jack Kennedy were having their first debate, and everybody thought Nixon would clean his clock because Nixon really knew how to debate. And as they're leaving the green room, Bobby yells to his brother, kick him in the balls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, that's the kind of brother you want in life, a cheerleading brother who cheers you on to take on the tough guy. And Jack went in there like a ball of fire against Nixon. So I think, whereas Nixon's running mate, Henry Cabot Lodge, said to him, erase the assassin's image. What a downer. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, he didn't, I don't think the guy liked Nixon too much. And he basically said, stop looking so spooky and scary.
Speaking of taking on the tough guys, Let's talk a little bit about before John Kennedy was president, before Bobby Kennedy was a senator or a presidential candidate. He had a career trying to fight guys like Jimmy Hoffa. He tangled with Hoffa in the late 50s.
Frightening people.
What was that like? I mean, you talk about frightening. He not only took on Hoffa, he also took on the mafia.
Yeah, well, I think he had this good guy. I think he was very Catholic in a sense that he was Michael the Archangel with a sword, and he was going after the devil, in this case, the mob. And J. Edgar Hoover, whatever you think of J. Edgar Hoover, never wanted to take on the mob or even recognize the existence of the mafia. But the first thing Bobby did when he became attorney general was make sure he had a list. He put together a list of all the top mob leaders. They had just met at Appalachia, New York. And he said, I want a list of every one of them. I want to use the IRS to get every one of them. I'm going to get them. When he's taking them on in the Rackets Committee as chief counsel from 1957 to 60, it was like he was just taunting them. He had Giancana, the godfather, the successor to Capone, who hung people up on meat hooks, right in front of him in the hearing room, and he would just taunt him, saying, what are you, giggling? I thought just little girls giggled. Right to his face, he was taunting him. Mm. And on this, you read about in the book, Frank Heerdorf, who was the arsonist, who, you know, the guy who was burnt to a crisp in his last operation and wouldn't talk to the police at the end. It was just so tough. But, you know, Bobby was out there all alone pretty much because his father was dealing with Giancana to help him win West Virginia. Jack Kennedy was having an affair with Giancana's girlfriend, Judy Campbell. And at the same time, the CIA under Eisenhower was using Giancana and some other mob figures to kill Castro. Meanwhile, Bobby is out there prosecuting the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't doubt why he thought after his brother was killed, maybe there was something to do with his, you know, militance towards the mob.
Yep.
That may have led to Jack being killed, although he always went along with the Warren Commission.
Let's go back to the Hoffa battles as well.
Sure.
Do you think that affected his organized labor support later on?
Yeah, labor never liked, or two enemies he made with that. I'll be rough here. One is the big city Democratic machines around the country. There was a lot of close contact between the mob and crooked unions, and a lot of them worked with Democratic organizations in big cities. I'm not saying they were mobbed up, those big city organizations, but they were close. They had close ties with these mobsters. Mm-hmm. And like in some Midwest cities like, you know, Gary and places like that, and, you know, real problems. And so he alienated a lot of these big city mayors who were basically big city machine operators. They ran Democratic machines, ethnic machines. And also the clean unions like the UAW, we're always very suspicious of Bobby after that because they thought he was anti-union. But in fact, he had come to believe that he was fighting for the rank-and-file guy and woman against the crooked people, you know, that were Dave Beck and Hoffa who were stealing from them. And he, in dealing with the mob, using their pension fund to get to the mob. And I think he did make some enemies there. In fact, that all came to a head in 1960 at the convention when his brother picked Lyndon Johnson as his running mate, after Bobby had promised the union bosses that would never happen because Johnson was from a right-to-work state in Texas, and they were anti-union people in the South, clearly. And so they held it against him. But, you know, Bobby really, that's one of the reasons Bobby hated having Johnson on the ticket, because he thought that basically double-crossed the good labor leaders like the Ruther brothers at the UAW.
Mm-hmm. There's one part of the book, Chris, that I found incredibly moving, and that's where you write about the funeral train, carrying Bobby Kennedy's corpse in his coffin from New York to Arlington. I wonder if you would just talk a little bit about Baltimore in particular, because that really got me.
Well, of course, Baltimore has a large minority population, African-American people, and they knew the train was coming through, and we were all shocked by Bobby and his loss. And as the train came by, it was slow moving. It came by Baltimore Station there, Union Station there. And out of nowhere, 20,000 people came out. They just got up and went. I'm getting chills. They just all got up by themselves. There's no organization doing this. They individually got up and went to the train tracks and stood out over the train tracks. And as the train went by, they spontaneously sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Mm. I mean, this doesn't happen in American life. We don't do this. We do things. But this spontaneity of this affection. And then the white working class people, I've got pictures of in the book, of dirt poor white people along the tracks saluting him, with their kids, all with no shirts on, all really poor people, all lined up with, in this wonderfully affectionate salute to him. You know, that's what the book's about, Paul. That's why I wrote the book. I wanted to bring back the time when a political leader can unite both, maybe not bring them together, but unite them both in the same cause. And it hasn't been, since then we've had division.
Nothing but division, which brings me to modern day politics, which I've got to talk about while I have you here.
Sure.
Tomorrow is the special election in Alabama. Roy Moore, Doug Jones, who's going to win?
Well, I think the Roy Moore people have been very effective locally in doing two things. The reason I think they're going to win down there, and I'm not thrilled by it. One thing is they were able to make it an outsider versus insider. I just talked to a friend of mine who's got friends down there, and one of those things you hear, sort of an inside thing, that they feel that the northern liberal media, like me and all those have been trying to influence their vote, so they're just going to react to that and send us a message. We've heard that before, like in Wallace country, when he ran, George Wallace. Mm-hmm. I think they want to send a message, we're not going to listen to you guys, you outsiders. But I think the other thing is a values issue, and this Christian evangelical is very pro-life and anti-abortion, and I think they've been able to turn the issue to that so that if you go into the voting booth and you're Christian evangelical, which is most of the white people and African-Americans down there, you go, well, should I vote for a guy, Alex Jones, who supports abortion to the last day or whatever, very much pro-choice? And that means that it's on my conscience that I voted for the pro-choice, pro-abortion rights position. Or do I vote for this other guy and forgive my fellow Christian for his whatevers in the past? I just think it's an easier vote for one of those people to vote for Moore. Whatever I think of it, I just think that they've been able to turn the issue down there away from his personal misconduct years ago with young women, with girls, away from that to this question of where do you stand on the values questions. And therefore, I think it's going to be tough for Jones.
Do you think Jones can possibly turn out enough of the African-American population of Alabama to change that?
He's going to have to. He's going to have to.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in the state of Alabama today, party is race, race is party.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I saw the number there. 15%, I believe it is, of white Alabamians voted for Obama.
15%.
Yeah. Like that.
And 7 out of 10 in a recent poll say, I don't care what Roy Moore has done, I can't vote for the Democrat, which is exactly what you were just talking about.
Yeah, it's a country that's been divided now. And my own view is I mostly vote Democrat, or not always. And I'm not always in a couple of key times. I voted Republican. But I do think the Democrats are making a mistake making the total pro-choice position a litmus test. I think they've got to allow for people, especially working people, to take a pro-life position in their party and include them in a bigger tent. I think that's a mistake. I think they should get people to unite on economic and other issues and American issues and put that one aside from the debate. But that's just me talking. I'm a moderate. You know, I'm not a ferocious militant on those issues.
Speaking of a zero-tolerance policy, what do you think about the Democrats on Capitol Hill apparently having a zero-tolerance policy for sexual harassment and forcing Al Franken out last week?
Well, I hope they did it for the right reasons. If they really believed that he had to go because he had to go, I'd like to believe that's why they made a judgment. If they did it to sort of, you know, spruce up their image and regarding general elections and women's voting, I'm not sure that's the way the voters are going to see it. I think voters are going to, we'll see. Hillary Clinton made the calculation that Republican women in the suburbs, well-educated women, would all vote for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's the way they voted. I think they voted much more for Trump than anybody thought.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure these grand strategic symbolic moves make sense. If they think that if they thought that Al Franken should leave, fine. If they did it for symbolic reasons, I don't think that's appropriate. Mm-hmm. I think they should have judged him on what he had done. If they decided what he did was unacceptable, which most people maybe do believe, they should have done it on that, but not on the basis of a political judgment.
I wonder if the Democrats had a thin majority in the Senate. Let's say it was 51-49 Democrats. Would they then have said to Al Franken, you've got to go?
You asked the right question, sir, because that gets to my question. If it's political, be careful.
Mm-hmm.
People want judgment on value. They want people to judge on values, the things that they really do hold dear. And you can't you can't fake it. I think people are going to know this was what it was. Somebody had to take the fall. And we'll see. We'll see. I guess I have a prejudice in a little bit, although I think what Franken did was unacceptable. In fact, almost unreasonable to be behaved with people. But I did respect the way he gave up his career in show business and really hunkered down as a citizen of Minnesota for those years and really did the job of becoming a good U.S. senator.
Yep.
And I respected how difficult that was for him to do that. And I hate to see it all go to waste.
Yeah, I agree with you because I abhor the way he treated women on these multiple occasions.
I don't even get it. I don't even get that grabbing and groping stuff. I guess that's, to me, I'm 72 this December, but I don't know that world. I don't know. That's something I don't get. I just, that's old, something worse than old style, whatever it is.
But Lucy,
I did hear you couldn't get on the, here's what I did know.
Yeah.
I had an assistant for about 11 years, and she's from Missouri, and she told me that you didn't get on the elevator if Bob Packard was on the elevator or Strom Thurmond. That those old leches would actually grab you. I mean, they would physically grab you. It wasn't like a cute line or some even a flirtatious line. It was just grabbing you. But I thought that was fairly limited to those guys. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I've got a 23-year-old daughter, and when all of this started a couple of months ago in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein revelations, to see my own daughter using hashtag MeToo, that went right through my heart, Chris.
Yeah. Well, I've heard it from I've been hearing it. My wife told me about this, and she's a big Democratic leader up here, and she told me some stuff that I couldn't believe. Not physical, but just wise guy commentary that we don't need.
But the really bad part about losing an Al Franken, not necessarily him, but somebody like him, as abhorrent as what he did was, is this was one of the good guys and one of the smart guys. Capitol Hill does not have enough smart guys.
Thank you. I'm with you on this.
Okay.
It's a tough one. It's just a tough one.
Bad day. Before I let you go, did you go to Donald Trump's White House Christmas party for the media?
No, I don't think we've been invited. I know my wife doesn't want to go, but I don't know whether I would have gone or not. I'm not going, that's all I know.
What do you think of those who attend?
Maybe they'll get something out of it in terms of journalism. I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't know either.
It just seems...
I don't judge. I'm not a media critic. That's one thing I'm not in life.
Well,
I don't criticize other guys and women in the business. I just don't do it.
Yeah, but don't you think it's ridiculous to have a man who tells you that you're the enemy of the people and then go there and act like nothing's going wrong?
Paul, you make a strong case.
And you're the opinion commentator.
I know. I'm not going. Okay, you got me.
The book is called Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. It is a wonderful read about a man who might have changed history had he lived past his assassination in June of 1968, written by the man who hosts Hardball 5 days a week on MSNBC. Chris Matthews, thanks so much for your time today.
Well said. Thank you, sir.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.